undermines the credibility of the political system here. I was just reading a headline during this week, and it said very clearly that nobody trusts politicians in Britain. I guess politicians generally aren't trusted, but now it's pretty abysmal that actually politicians have pretty much lost their credibility in their entirety just with their economic policies, which are destroying their own Western nations here because they're siding with neoliberal corporate companies. But add to this now this notion of this kind of vague notion that they had that the Western civilization was in some way the kind of messiah of real civilization and was trying to sort the whole world out and was the paragon of justice and paragon of freedom, and all of that is out the window. Now you've got 85-year-old women in Britain being arrested just because they have a placard saying they support a Palestine Action, a group which takes on Israeli genocidal military companies, etc., based here in Britain. So it's falling apart. The kind of whole notion and the do-gooder West is falling apart in the minds of their own population. And I think the politicians are partly scared of that because they'll potentially lose votes around that. But also, I think that what they recognize is that where Israel is taking the world is basically lawlessness. If there's no regard to international law by Israel, then what stops any other nation also saying, well, I don't care about international law either? If there's no regard to attacking sovereign nations preemptively, you know, without any provocation, then what stops other nations saying, look, we're going to go in and hit other countries? What Israel is doing is it's openly setting the bar so low now that others can also join in, and it's actually inciting war around the world. And what's worse is that these politicians aren't that stupid, that if they know once Iran, for instance, has been rattled by the Israelis, and nobody expected for them to go that far, but they have. And had it gone a little further, had the Iranians not given the Israelis such a bloody nose in a short space of time, the Israelis could have provoked Iran into shutting down the Hormuz Straits, which would have meant an entire global economic meltdown, a spiraling inflation, spiraling chaos and migration around the world. And Israel really almost didn't care. It seemed like they didn't care what they were doing, and it's still not over. They still very likely will try to go for Iran again. So the world is not going to be left unaffected by what Israel's doing. And I think that's also sinking in to a lot of the politicians around the globe. And so they've got to come up with a more robust plan of how do you stop a rogue nation which is completely out of control, is nuclear armed, and has access to all of the surveillance technology which makes them able to penetrate every other nation's intelligence services, every other nation's government infrastructure. Nobody's safe. The Mossad, Unit 8200, are capable of infiltrating any one of these nations, and they can blackmail, as you've seen with the Epstein case, which is all going on. Any nation, any leader can be compromised by their surveillance mechanisms. And I think that is also scaring a lot of nations. Yes, and of course, with the backdrop of China and Russia and the Eurasian axis, alternative possibilities, of course, this is making a lot of instability.
Thank you, Sid. I want to get the same question to you, Paul. When the U.S. Calls Irish leadership about this anti-Israel bill, you very well know the financial fallout is not what's at concern here from the Irish not buying Israeli settler products. That's not the main concern, is it? It's the fear of a domino effect of precedent. And in fact, here it is. I searched it earlier. So the U.S. has voiced concerns that the bill could have unintended consequences and harm. This is a funny part here, both Israelis and Palestinians. However, Amnesty International has urged Ireland to stay firm in its commitment to justice and pass this bill, arguing it will set a strong example for other EU member states, Paul.
I don't know how strong an example it is. It's an example for sure, but the United States, we don't have statesmen, statespersons, and people who are looking out for the United States itself. And this is true in other countries. I would say the same with respect to Britain, France, and Germany, and other countries as well, that are not paying attention to what is in their real and immediate and long-term benefit. Because, as Saif pointed out, the Israelis do not care if there is a world war, if half the world is living under a nuclear cloud, because they're thinking about only about their own survival as a Zionist Jewish nation armed to the teeth. But they don't have the means. They're not big enough to impose directly their will upon other nations and other peoples. So they rely upon this. They don't care about closing the Strait of Hormuz or any of this. All they know that they can get whatever they want whenever they want it. And for the rest of the world, the United States especially, to go along with this, understanding how far they can be led by the nose, is just absurd. And it's and we have no people with take our president Donald Trump. He doesn't think in those terms. He thinks in terms of how can we impose our will today on country A or tomorrow on country B and all this sort of thing. That's all he thinks about. He thinks about his future support within the government and within the country and how he's going to he and his cronies are going to make money out of all of this, which they certainly can out of more weapons manufacturing. I think we have to think about what's in our immediate future, not our long-term future.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you both for joining us on the program there. Paul Lurie, their co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Northern California in the States, and Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us out of London, the United Kingdom. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist philosopher who coined the term cultural hegemony, believes soft power is the main cause of hegemony. He believes only those governments can impose their hegemony that exercise persuasive power as well as direct force. With the end of the Cold War, the United States used its military, political, economic, and media capacity to carry out different operations in countries caught up in civil war. And with its political and economic reforms, it tried to build its desired society in target countries and empower forces dependent on itself in those countries. This way, it could complete its power puzzle over the world. American imperialism has always been hand in hand with American exceptionalism. Ever since the idea of the Destiny Manifesto gained influence in the 19th century, the United States extended its own presence and influence not only from beach to beach in North America, but also across all nations of the world. Perhaps what's most evident about America in power games is that it is a novice with imperial equations. In the 19th century, when European powers, especially England and France, were building their vast external empires, the United States was still busy with committing genocide against Native Americans and with its civil wars. In the 1890s, when the United States had stretched across from beach to beach, the next step was to go beyond its borders and occupy other parts of the world. Another concept connected to a tradition of American exceptionalism is finding a spiritual goal for war. This approach means to conceal inhumane American acts in time of war with these other nations. As Harry Stout, the American missionary, has said, America's belief is in war as a religious tool and a holy commitment all over the world. Some thinkers believe Westernization of the world is a continuation of its Christianization, and that this trend continues in a different, reconstructed form. Globalization of the West has roots in pre-Renaissance Christianity. The nature of Western Christianity post-Renaissance has itself undergone change in the process of becoming worldly and global. But globalization is actually one and the same as historic Western religious and cultural and civilizational expansionism on the rise. Actually, distorted Christianity in the West now directly serves to spread Western civilization and thought. The method of comparing religious belief and the new Western culture is also very interesting.
But we're burning something and we're actually convinced of it. And according to the Bible, it's actually true what we're saying.
The behavioral pattern of Western culture has been reconstructed based on moral tolerance advocated by distorted Christianity. And to other nations, this moral tolerance is a sign of progress in Western civilization and piety. In other words, via globalization, it is possible to become both Christian and hedonistic, and also progressive and civilized in choosing a Western interpretation of life, humankind, society, nature, and history. As a matter of fact, to the young generation of the world, the allure of globalization is this very characteristic of Western civilization. Of course, there's much to be said also from the other side of the story. Religious elements have never easily faced accepting the infiltration of Western culture. After World War I and understanding the importance of expanding international relations, international organizations were established to monitor human rights observance. This slowly weakened the national sovereignty of countries. Some thinkers believe a traditional religious outlook saw itself confronted by the international community's social, cultural, and political currents. This caused the Salafi school of thought to enter into an unprecedented war with Western civilization in the early 21st century. An occurrence clearly evident in the attack on the New York Trade Center Twin Towers. This incident signifies the conflict between religious understanding and globalization. Of course, there are other interpretations of the incident also, which say all relevant currents, such as the Twin Tower explosions, were pre-planned by Westerners. Despite all these interpretations, some believe the 21st century will see the world turn to religion. Many people are adopting Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. However, taking to Islam has a totally different reason. People are becoming Muslim because they are critical of the conditions and situation of Western civilization and the globalization trend.
I describe what seems to me to be a central feature of the post-Cold War world as far as international politics is.
Samuel Huntington, a political science expert, has a theory called the Clash of Civilizations. He had predicted that after the Cold War, the source of all conflict would be religious culture and identity.
Who are we? The challenges to America's national identity.
He had predicted the tug of war between the Western world and Muslim world. The truth of the matter is, one of the greatest impediments to Western civilization infiltrating Middle Eastern societies is Islam. As an example, we can study Lebanon. Although European and American missionaries had set up plenty of schools and media in Lebanon, the Lebanese resistance movement took form with a completely Islamic identity in the 1980s in the atmosphere of security and identity conflict. William Raff, an American Foreign Service officer and political theoretician, believes the positive view Arabs had of America was damaged for several reasons. Raff believes the first reason is the issue of Palestine. Arabs are angry with America for its all-round support of the regime occupying Al-Quds.
Christian Zionism at its simplest is Christian support for Zionism, but we need to unpack that. Today, Zionism is essentially a secular movement driven by Jewish people who believe that they have a right to historic Palestine, and we see in the present policies of the Israeli government quite a racist, supremacist approach to claiming the land, colonizing the land, driving Palestinians off their historic homeland, instituting laws that preference Jewish people over non-Jews and so on. Christian Zionism is primarily a religious movement with political implications.
Another reason is that Western powers have insulted the character of the Prophet of Islam on different occasions, offending Muslim pride. Yet another reason is that on the 9th anniversary of the 9/11 act of terror, a radical pastor called Terry Jones announced he meant to hold a ceremony to set the Quran on fire.
We are going to have an international burn a Quran day.
Every non-Muslim is an infidel. Their lands, their women, their children are our spoils.
And finally, the making of the film Innocence of Muslims in 2012 incensed Muslims to a point that American embassies were attacked in several Muslim countries. All these measures have weakened U.S. soft power among Muslims. Of course, in addition to points made by Raff, there have been other instances of insult to the Prophet of Islam and Muslims. For example, the film Fitna, meaning Cause of Division, made in 2008 by a Dutch politician, which provoked a global backlash. Also, a trend started of drawing caricatures of the Prophet of Islam, the first of which was by the Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten. All such acts hurt Muslim pride globally.
At the beginning of the 19th century, you find Christian leaders advocating for the return of the Jewish people to Palestine, because they believe this is what their scriptures mandated. So Christian Zionism preceded Jewish Zionism by at least 50 years. And then in terms of its presence today, we have to say that 9 out of 10 Zionists today are Christians. So although we associate Zionism with Jews and with Israel, the irony is that 9 out of 10 Zionists today are Christians. And so although as a minority, it's a secular political philosophy or movement, the reality is that the great majority of Zionists today are religious and they are Christian. They're driven by the belief that somehow the contemporary Israel is the fulfillment of promises God made in the Bible to his chosen people.
An instance of U.S. meddling in other countries' internal affairs came to be seen in color revolutions, a post-communist occurrence. A color revolution is an anti-violence revolution for regime change. After the Cold War, color revolutions were rolled out in Eastern Bloc countries to totally eliminate the two great barriers before U.S. hegemony, China and Russia.
He's one of the richest men in the world. He's given away a staggering $32 billion. But is the billionaire philanthropist George Soros at the heart of a global conspiracy?
When you look at the entirety of what the foundations have done, it's been very worthwhile and very effective. Yet if you look at individual programs, many have failed. We have had many difficulties. In Russia, we have had about three putches where the foundation had to be cleaned up. Mm-hmm. So it's been one long struggle with lots of difficulties. But when you look at the results, very rewarding.
An institute obviously involved in guiding color revolutions is the Open Society Institute, OSI, owned by an American Jewish capitalist called George Soros. This foundation evaluates dissidents to the central government in countries of interest to provide the grounds for peaceful revolution by providing financial support to anti-government student movements.
Trying to improve the world is more difficult than making money. You can only measure it if you have a strategy. I set up a foundation to promote this idea of an open society. Opening up closed societies, making open societies function better, and foster a critical mode of thinking.
For example, with the Rose Revolution in Georgia or Orange Revolution of Ukraine, anti-central government groups succeeded in creating structural change with support from this foundation. Of course, the U.S. government's footprints can be traced anywhere popular protest has been guided against the legitimate government. For example, in the Middle East, where the Syrian civil war is the most recent and bitterest example. The American strategy till before 2011 was after a way to topple Assad. When Islamic Awakening sprouted in early 2011, the Obama administration grabbed it as a chance to oust Assad. When Assad proved his steadfastness, Obama ordered the CIA to align with Saudi and Turkish efforts for toppling the regime by supporting anti-regime local fighters, including mercenaries supported by Saudi Arabia. But the quick ousting of Assad, which American strategies dreamt of, turned into a full-scale local war which only set fire to the Syrian people's lives. For the moment, America's general diplomacy policy in the Middle East is basically in line with reducing negative impacts of its military meddling. This is why a theoretician such as Joseph Nye stresses time and again that to infiltrate other nations, America must take a path of imposing soft power, so that other wrong tactical calculations that damage U.S. credibility with Middle Eastern nations and governments do not occur. Joseph Nye compares the distribution of power in the world to a three-dimensional chessboard, at the head of which is military power and the world's only power, the United States. The next rung of power is economic. Power at this level is multipolar, balancing between America, Europe, China, and Japan. But on the third row of the chessboard is external relations, meaning occurrences beyond the control of governments. Instances such as global warming, pandemics, and drug smuggling. At this stage, the only practical solution is cooperation between nations and governments. And there is no other solution. Nye believes the zero-power summary game is no longer any use. What is of use is the positive power summary, meaning there are no more winners and losers in the world.
People like Joseph Nye and others, to some extent, speculate upon what this post-Cold War era will look like in terms of the international sphere. So what you see is an understanding, or an analysis at least, that we're moving to a much more flexible, a much more dynamic consideration of power, i.e. in the Cold War period we have essentially two blocks, capitalist and communist. We've also got a non-aligned movement, but we have these two kind of hegemonic blocks competing with each other, and the two, well, let's just say that it's quite a simple scenario where good conduct, for example, is only a small part of the requirement here. So states that we might hold up as being more moral actors, you know, states that are not, for example, dictatorships, or states that don't suppress their people in different ways, they almost have more of a, are perhaps received better in the international community, at least on whichever side they align to. However, as we move into the post-Cold War period, there's an understanding that, as I say, the definition or the consideration of power, and particularly what matters or what counts when it comes to power, is a bit more is a bit more flexible. So soft power is, I guess, as I say, this an identification that things are changing.
9, 8, 7. It's noon in Los Angeles, 3 o'clock in Washington, and four big stories are developing right now.
In today's political equations, what's most important is superiority of narrative. Even a 30-second commercial film advertising shampoo or toothpaste will bear no effect if it's not successful in its narrative. For a text to be effective, its narrative must be seemingly correct and simple. Joseph Nye points to the importance of narrative given what the time calls for. In our times, anyone winning the war of narratives is the final winner. Now, these American narratives, spun by a few non-governmental organizations, try to paint the United States in a positive, holy, humane, and peaceful light.
To officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
The move comes with consequences, and American embassies around the world are already bracing for trouble.
Talk about the emergency response now. You see there Isabel Coleman. She is the deputy administrator at USAID. Isabel, I know this is a very busy time for you and your organization, so thank you for joining us. We understand some aid from the States is on the ground in Turkey and in Syria. Tell us about what's already there and about the commitment you're making for what's ahead.
Yes, thank you. I mean, it really is just an unbelievable situation. we were able to get two of our search and rescue teams on the ground in Turkey yesterday.
It is the nature of cultural change in societies to be gradual and slow. So to fully observe the cultural effects of a phenomenon, one must be patient.
If our culture is unattractive to others, then a given cultural artifact doesn't produce soft power. It may produce the opposite. It may produce revulsion. So if you take an American TV program or American film in which women are shown running around in bikinis and divorcing their husbands and working, and you show that in Saudi Arabia, that's not attractive to the religious conservatives who rule those countries. But there is an interesting dimension to that. If you ask, is Baywatch attractive to run Iran? Clearly not. Doesn't create any soft power. But if you ask, what do young Iranian teenagers want? They want to see an American video in the privacy of their homes. So you can attract some people and repulse or repel others at the same time.
Perhaps more time is needed to study the effects of America's cultural measures on Middle Eastern belief, behavior, and lifestyle. A foundation such as USAID, in addition to its economic activities, exacts plenty of focus, expense, and energy on cultural activity in target countries. Change made in the lifestyles of these people is evident enough, but perhaps it has not yet reached its climax. Even so, if we monitor the activities of these supposedly cultural organizations, such as USAID, USEP, and NED, we can pinpoint and predict key cultural changes to come with high accuracy.
Mother. On September 17, 2024, in towns across southern Lebanon and in parts of Syria, a new kind of terror was unleashed. At around 3:30 in the afternoon, small black pagers began exploding inside homes, markets, and schools.
In Lebanon, at least 12 people were killed, over 2,800 injured Tuesday, when electronic pagers used by members of Hezbollah exploded at the same time.
Playing out hundreds of times across Lebanon within the space of an hour, a targeted, coordinated, highly technical attack.
And hospitals struggling with an influx of more than 3,000 injured people.
The next day, it was walkie-talkies.
Dozens of radios exploded earlier today.
Walkie-talkies explode throughout Lebanon over the course of 2 days.
What followed was a two-month Israeli bombardment campaign. Thousands were killed, a fifth of Lebanon's population displaced. And the community, seen as the backbone of Hezbollah, the Shia population of southern Lebanon, was bombed, hunted, and left to bury its dead. Israel was trying to deter Hezbollah from intervening against the genocide in Gaza. Later, it would be revealed that the pagers were booby-trapped, sold to Hezbollah by a front company tied to the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency. The Israelis named the operation Grim Reaper. They claimed they were targeting fighters, but these are the people who paid the price.
Leaving Berish, a village in South Lebanon, we were just visiting Ali, one of the victims of the pager attacks, and we're on our way to Dibba, another village, to visit Hussein, who's also a victim. He's 12 years old of the pager attacks. These kids, their lives have been completely upended. Lots of facial disfiguration. They've lost fingers. Many of them can't see. It's quite heavy stuff.
As a doctor, somehow you are trained to dissociate yourself from this compassion with the patient, but it fails many times. When you see your young people coming to you, this is the future of your country. Perhaps your kids, your neighbor, your parents, you see them. It's very hard to dissociate yourself. They were part of my Lebanon, my dream. And taking care of them, I'm reconstructing, rebuilding my country.
Ali and Hussein are more than survivors. They're friends, and in each other, they find a reflection of what they've lost and what they still have. The Israelis insist they were targeting fighters. So why were so many civilians, including children, among the injured? Zainab Mistra was injured by a pager at her parents' house in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Human rights lawyer Craig McIver says the attacks on Lebanese civilians were no accident.
Many of those who were victimized by these attacks were civilians, were women and children, medical workers and others. And even some of those who were targeted were not combatants. They may have been affiliated with Hezbollah, but mere affiliation with a political organization does not make someone a legitimate target under international law.
Sheikh Mustafa Shaib, a religious scholar, was also badly injured in the attack.
All of it was a part of a campaign of terror against certain parts of the Lebanese population for a political purpose. So it clearly meets the general understanding of what terrorism is. It constitutes an act of aggression.
We're in Burj Rahal in South Lebanon, and we're heading to Sheikh Mustafa's house, where he lives with his wife and two young daughters.
Sheikh Mustafa is a teacher, a father, and a scholar. He isn't a fighter. But on September 17, 2024,
a pager exploded in his hands. Now he's blind. Sheikh Mustafa teaches at a religious school in South Lebanon that's affiliated with the political wing of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was formed in the early 1980s to resist Israel's invasion and occupation of Lebanon. It liberated the South in 2000 and beat back another Israeli invasion in 2006. After that humiliation, Israel began planning the next round. The pager attack was part of that plan. Like other Lebanese political parties, Hezbollah runs schools, clinics, and infrastructure for the constituency that voted them into parliament. The pagers were a basic tool, a secure means of communication across the community, until Israel turned them into weapons, weapons that turned people into bombs. The blast left him completely blind. His face was torn apart. He's undergone dozens of surgeries. When he got prosthetic eyes, his daughters thought he could see again. He had to explain that he couldn't. Israel's pager attack was practically celebrated across the West. The media called it sophisticated. American officials hailed it as precise and targeted.
Wolf, indeed, the Mossad has a long, fascinating history of using methods like this, the latest in a long line of audacious, lethal, sometimes high-tech operations by the legendary Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad.
The Israelis are the best.
Today, they look like James Bond, carrying out an attack in Lebanon.
Targeting and eliminating membership and leadership of Hezbollah, I absolutely support that. In fact, if anything, I love it.
Israeli leaders and their supporters take pride in the attack and have often turned it into a joke, handing out pager trophies to political allies and threatening to use pagers against their adversaries while mocking victims as their bodies undergo surgery after surgery.
I'm a supporter of the Palestinians. I'm used to it.
I hope your beeper doesn't go off. The thing is that
you just say I should die.
Beep, beep.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett joked that he planned to pass out pagers to students protesting his appearance at Harvard University. Supporters of Israel joked about giving a pager to Mahmoud Khalil's newborn baby after he was detained by ICE over his opposition to the genocide in Gaza. The Mossad agents who engineered the attack were praised as national heroes in Israel and given airtime in Western media to justify it.
That although it's ugly, it has character.
And yet if you were to tune in to the broadcast of the media corporations in the United States or listen to American politicians, you would think that Israel had achieved something great, that it was some sort of precision strike against the bad guys, when in fact, it was an atrocity.
Craig McKiber is the former director of the New York office of the UN Commissioner for Human Rights. He resigned in October 2023 in protest of the UN's failure to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza. While Western media celebrated the attack, Craig had a different name for it.
But what we saw with the use of these pagers was a clear and gross violation of international law. It could certainly be defined as terrorism because it was intended to spread terror across the population in Lebanon.
Even former CIA director Leon Panetta framed it the same way.
Is it terrorism?
I don't think there's any question that it's a form of terrorism.
Under international law, the pager attack checks nearly every box for illegality.
The booby trapping of ordinary civilian devices is prohibited in all circumstances. That is a war crime in and of itself. It doesn't meet the test of international humanitarian law of the principle of distinction, that is, being able to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. It is a violation of the principle of precaution. It also is a violation of international human rights law that prohibits arbitrary, summary, or extrajudicial executions.
And even if Israel's claims were true, that all the pagers belonged to Hezbollah fighters, Craig says the attack would still be a war crime.
Neither can they claim that some of those who were killed were victims of so-called collateral damage. A child who was killed by an exploding pager is not the victim of collateral damage. They are the victim of a war crime.
For the victims, there's no confusion about who helped and who harmed. While the U.S. sent weapons and shielded Israel diplomatically, Iran sent doctors, planes, and medical care free of charge. The attack's cruelty extended beyond the initial blast. Lebanese MP Ilyas Jaradi an ophthalmologist who treated many of the victims, described what followed as a corneal siege, an effort to prevent Hezbollah members and their communities from accessing critical eye surgeries. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Israel pressured the Lebanese government to ban Iranian planes from landing in Beirut, making the journey for pager attack victims seeking medical care even more difficult. Sheikh Mustafa wasn't alone. Zainab Mestra was injured by a pager as well, and she's no fighter either. She's an interior designer and an event planner. The unprecedented and lawless nature of this attack has unleashed a new uncertain era of warfare for the whole world.
And when you have terror going into the supply chain, it makes people ask the question, what the hell is next?
What now is to stop anyone in the world from booby trapping anything in the supply chain, food products, for example, water, ordinary household devices, any of those can now be used as a booby trap in order to target people that are deemed to be the enemy by any state, by any armed group, by any actor on the planet. And you have to ask yourself, what would drive a state to be so bold in its blatant violation of international law? Impunity of the state of Israel has been guaranteed for 8 decades by the West, United Kingdom, United States, Germany, and others. And the product of impunity is always more violations, worse violations, expanding circles of atrocity.
Militarily, these attacks exacted a heavy human toll. But politically, if Israel thought the bombs would fracture loyalties and erode the base of support for Hezbollah in South Lebanon, that seems unchanged. If anything, it appears to have hardened the commitments of those who bore the brunt of the attack.
good morning to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. By the way, you're listening to Iran Radio. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: President Pezeshkian says allegations about Iran's nuclear program being over are illusion, stressing that uranium enrichment will continue within the framework of international law. Israeli forces kill more than 38 seekers within a single day in Gaza as the regime's genocide rages on across the blockaded territory. And also coming up, the UN chief describes the situation in Gaza as a horror show, but a level of death and destruction without parallel in recent times. Thank you for being with us. The Iranian president says allegations about Iran's nuclear program being over are an illusion, expressing that uranium enrichment will continue within the framework of international law. In an interview with Al Jazeera Network, Masoud Pezeshkian said Iran's nuclear capabilities lie in the minds of its scientists, not just in facilities. He reiterated that Iran does not seek to develop nuclear weapons, describing it as the country's political, religious, humanitarian, and strategic stance. Pezeshkian said, during the 12-day U.S.-Israeli imposed war, Israel sought to eliminate Iran through chaos and targeting the system, but it failed. He stressed that it was Iran's ability to strike deep inside the occupied territories that forced Israel to seek a ceasefire. Pezeshkian emphasized that Iran is prepared for any military action and its forces are ready to strike deep inside Israel again. He noted that any future negotiations must be based on a win-win approach, as Iran will not discuss or accept threats or dictates. A ceremony titled Forever Iran has been held in Tehran's iconic Vahdat Hall, honoring artists, poets, writers, and journalists who lost their lives during the 12-day Israeli aggression against Iran. Fatima Masumi has the details.
A tribute to martyrs who held pens, brushes, and camera lenses, not guns, in their hands. They were not soldiers in uniform, but defenders of Iranian identity. Artists, poets, journalists, Quran reciters, and memorizers, and members of mosque cultural centers, innocently martyred during the 12-day Israeli aggression. High-ranking officials, cultural figures, artists, and journalists gathered in Tehran's Vahdat Hall to honor their memory.
The Iranian people will never yield to force or oppression. The occupying Zionist regime continues to violate international law with impunity, invading neighboring countries, committing assassinations, and carrying out acts of aggression without restraint. The sensitive hearts of the artists, journalists, and poets feel these atrocities more deeply than most.
The ceremony is filled with heartfelt tributes, displays of the martyrs' art and live performances, all echoing a single message: though they are gone, they will not be forgotten. It's a message that resonates with Iranians from all walks of life, uniting them in the face of foreign aggression.
The widespread solidarity of the people during these 12 days showed how individuals from different backgrounds, beliefs, and ethnicities all united around the idea of Iran and spoke with one voice. From the very beginning of the crisis, the cultural, artistic, and media communities were fully engaged.
During the 12-day Israeli aggression, Iranians found strength and solidarity. The ceremony is a reminder that even the deepest tragedies can be transformed into collective resilience.
We are all Iranians. When Iran is in pain, we feel that pain too. When Iran faces a problem, it concerns us as well. We are here at this ceremony with a deep sense of affection and devotion to our homeland.
We lost, unfortunately, a lot of our artists in these recent events, but it shows that the nation are united, and we are celebrating the unification of our nation.
The families of the fallen were also honored, many clutching portraits of their loved ones, a young photojournalist, a Quran memorizer, a provincial poet. Their legacy now lives on in the hearts of a nation.
The martyrs honored in this ceremony were not soldiers on the battlefield or military personnel. They were artists, writers, photographers, and poets innocently killed. Their legacy, however, endures through every brushstroke, poem, and melody as Iran pays tribute to voices silenced but destined never to be forgotten. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Death and destruction continue to ravage Gaza nearly 22 months into Israel's